Everyone deserves to be safe. The LEAVE initiative provides mental health support to those impacted by intimate partner violence, also known as domestic violence. We take a holistic approach to help survivors of any age find ways to heal and thrive. Our virtual and in-person services include crisis and individual counseling sessions, support groups, psychotherapy, community-sensitive emergency housing, and linkages to a variety of community resources. The LEAVE initiative is brought to the community by the Jewish Board in partnership with UJA Federation. For more information, contact us confidentially at lave@jbfcs.org. That's lev@jbfcs.org or 646-273-1800.
Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
Welcome to the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association, or JOMA podcast. I'm your host, Elisa Minkin. I'm a general pediatrician and proud JOMA member. And today I'm really honored and really excited to be interviewing Dr. Shoshana Friedman from Shalom Task Force. If there are topics you want to hear, if you have comments on any of the episodes, if you know someone you want to be interviewed, or you yourself want to be interviewed, please reach out to us at health, H-E-A-L-T-H, at joma.org. Before I introduce Dr. Friedman, I'm also going to add a trigger warning because this is a difficult topic. We're going to be discussing various forms of what's called intimate partner violence, what used to be called domestic violence or spouse abuse. And obviously that can be triggering to some people. I think it's very important, but listener discretion is advised. And this is for mature audiences. Dr. Shoshana or Shana Friedman is the executive director of Shalom Task Force. She is a trauma-informed therapist and advocate where she has worked in the field of domestic abuse and family violence within the Jewish community for 20 years. She serves in several community leadership roles and was recently appointed to the New York City Mayor's Office to End Domestic and Gender-Based Violence Advisory. She lectures regularly about intimate partner abuse, sexual abuse, trauma, and culturally informed practice, where she has published on this and related subjects. Welcome, Dr. Friedman. Thank you so much for joining me today.
My absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you.
No, it's mine. You know, it's a really, really important topic. And, you know, I had to review preparing for this talk to see if I've, you know, when I've covered it last. It was over 2 years ago. I only did really one talk on it. It was Love Shouldn't Hurt with therapist Anna Sherman, July of 2021. So almost 2 years ago. And it was actually, we got a ton of listens to that one. Shows me it's a really important topic, and we really have so much that we have to discuss about it today.
You know, so. I'll say that podcasts that address this are so important because it makes the material accessible in a way that it isn't otherwise for people who could find a private space to listen. So I thank you for doing that. Right. I really appreciate that.
No, and I appreciate you reaching out to me to do this. Yeah. So let's talk about, let's start, we're going to do a little bit of overlap with that other podcast because we really have to just make sure that the definitions are clear. We, you know, we explain what all the terms we're going to be using are.
Okay. So I guess you want me to start a little bit?
Yes, yes. I want you to explain.
You're
the expert.
Or I try to be. You know, I'm coming from Shalom Task Force, and our work is really in the space of what we call domestic abuse. It's really intimate partner violence. That's the term used in the literature because it really is talking about people in relationships. Adolescents or teens and adults are in what would be considered romantic dating marriage relationships. So we're not here to talk about child abuse. I would defer to you about that. We're not here to talk about elder abuse. We're talking about the idea of people in a relationship. And when we talk about domestic abuse, spouse abuse, relationship violence, you're really talking about a pattern of behaviors that one partner asserts over the other partner to maintain and obtain power and control. So like the key words there are patterns of behavior, power and control, and it instills fear. So it's important to kind of lean into those, I usually say the bolded words, a pattern, pattern, power and control, and fear, to really make a distinction between, let's say, a relationship that might be going through a hard time, high conflict, that those of us who have been blessed to be in long-term relationships know there can be hard times, but there's a real distinct difference between a relationship that might be just struggling when one that has this pattern of power and control, and that one that that there's a level of fear. And when you're able to understand that, that part of the definition, and that makes us be able to help people more and understand what the dynamic is much more. And the other important part about that, and we're going to get into this in a bit, I'm sure, is that nowhere in there did I say physical abuse. Mm-hmm. And people are always looking when I say, how do you define domestic violence? They'll say, oh, and someone's hurting, hitting, slapping, you know, what we would label as physical abuse. And certainly that is a part of domestic violence. And certainly that is the high risk behaviorism where we're doing assessments for fatality, God forbid, or injury, that what we're looking at as well. But when we're talking about the larger definition and the experience of the survivors, it's really much larger than that. I come from a clinical background with working with survivors, particularly in the FRM community. And I've run many support groups for survivors. And what they say they would love the community to understand is that it's not the physical abuse that hurts most, and that it's much larger than that. It's often the other forms of abuse. So I think we should start, you know, just start with that, understanding that.
Yeah, I'd like you to list the other forms, because we actually have a long list. So physical, okay. Again, we've gone through, that's the most obvious. Kind of think of that as the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, yes. So, and you know, the model that we often think about is something called the Duluth model. We don't have to get into now, but it's a good visualization of it, because it's like a circle. In the middle, it says power and control. And on the outside, it says, you know, physical and sexual assault or incidents. So like, that's what keeps everything together. And everything else in the middle is like the toolkit of the person that hurts, or the abuser, however you want to label that person. And those, that toolkit of things to keep someone, to control someone, include emotional, verbal, and psychological abuse. So things like gaslighting, name calling, shattering that person's sense of self so they can't make decisions for themselves, making them question themselves and their own sanity and their competency. So then we walk into things like financial abuse. We think about, that's not budgeting, and that's where the distinctions are, right? Like, that's where, like, you know, it's not about having a conversation about budgeting or going through a hard time and trying to figure that out, or even arguing about money in your family. It's about not having any voice around how money is used, having the other person ruining your credit, that person making sure you can't, you know, getting you fired because they're bothering you at work so much, taking away that person's like agency around their own like financial life. And that's what we'll see. Like, and we actually see a lot of that in the communities we serve, where there's a lot of financial abuse. And again, it's not about a budget. It's about, you know, not having access to money for your basic needs when there is the capacity in the family. It's about not allowing the person to work, or the paycheck goes into a bank account that the person who's being hurt doesn't have access to. You know, taking out many credit cards so that if they would choose to think about options, they would have terrible credit and couldn't rent an apartment. So to really think about that. So then there's, you know, what we think about now is digital or cyber abuse. I know when we work with kids and teens, you talk about cyber bullying, and certainly that's part of it. But it's even control around using technology to keep control and knowing tabs wherever you are. And if you think about it, like nowadays, all of our phones, all those who have smartphones, like they're very easy to locate, right? So if you're going to, you don't want your spouse to know that you're going to therapy every Wednesday at 11 a.m. and they're following you on your iPhone, right? They know exactly where you are. Or you just, every minute, like, what are you doing there? Back 20 years ago, or a little bit more, when I started doing this work, I remember working with a client that was engaged, and her chassan gave her a beeper. So that ages all of us who know what a beeper is, but a beeper, right? And she would get these phone calls, and within like seconds, she'd have to pick it up, right? She didn't call back. You'd get very angry. And there was like, and that was one way of controlling her. And nowadays we see that more with texts or using location devices or using, and then there's other ways, you know, then there's exposing, we call it revenge pornography, you know, sharing pictures without consent. And there are ways of technology. So we've done physical, verbal, emotional, psychological, and this is an over, you know, there's lots to say about all of these, financial, cyber, And then there's sexual abuse, even in marriage. There needs to be consent. There needs to be discussion. Saying once, yes, once, does that mean there's always permission? You know, and that, again, those are where there's distinction, like having a conversation about trying something different or new is one thing. And then being forced to do something that's out beyond your comfort zone, or being forced, and in our community, being forced to do things during Nida, a time where, according to Jewish law, it would be considered prohibited, you know, things like that. That's where we move into control, right? So that's where the distinctions are important. And then something that's, I wouldn't say unique to the Jewish community, but very particular to faith-based communities, is this idea of religious or spiritual abuse. Now, people define it in many different ways. I think that we're still kind of figuring it out. But again, if we lean into the definition of power and control and patterns of behavior, it's the use of religion, spirituality, relationship with Hashem, halacha, to control someone. So that could look, it could look different for different people. It could be forcing someone to be over on a mitzvah, like not keep transgress something when they don't want to, and that, what does that feel like, right? It could be prohibiting someone from doing something, or it should be forcing someone. And again, that's not having, you know, people get married and they might have, you know, may have similar hashkafos or similar observance, or they might have some distinction. That does not define the quality of the marriage, right? The ability to navigate that is what we're talking about, right? So you could not agree with your partner about how to keep Shabbos or how strict you want to be about kosheris or something. Okay, if you're forced to do something and you have no voice to say, this is how I want to do it. Now, you might eventually come to some sort of compromise. And again, that's not abuse, right? Compromise is not an abuse, because there's conversation, discussion, negotiation. It's when you're forced. So the use of halacha to force someone, to control someone, it's also, you know, there's many ways to think about it and defining it. It's using halacha to kind of excuse behaviors, right? That it's within my right to tell you this, or you have to do it this way because my rabbi, even if they've never asked a rabbi, and truth be told, if you call a rav and they only hear how that one person presents this small snippet of a conversation, right? You know, and then, you know, the other piece, which I believe you've talked to others about, and there's been a lot of conversation about in the community, is, you know, the idea of gets, the get refusal, as being a form of religious abuse, in the sense of, right? Like, the sense of, it's a way someone controls someone through a religious vehicle. Now, it's not that everybody becomes an aguna. That's not the reality, you know. But I would say almost all the observant from women I've treated, counseled over the years, fear it. They fear it. So it informs their choices, even if it's never going to be the reality. Even if the husband will grant a divorce, a get at a reasonable time, that's, you know, within there, and that's, you know, kind of community specific sometimes, but the idea that there's this capacity, that he has that kind of control, when someone chooses to leave a relationship and chooses to pursue divorce and separation, knowing that's kind of on the table and can inform, could become an aguna situation, often will inform how they negotiate other parts of their divorce and how they function. Right. At time. So that's like a general overview of many different forms. The important part here, I think, is to recognize it doesn't have to be physical. And the importance of recognizing that non-physical abuse, something we often call coercive control, is real. It's also dangerous. I mean, it has significant mental health outcomes. It leads to physically dangerous behavior. And if we're able to find and see those things earlier, then we could help get interventions so that it doesn't become more dangerous. So that's why it's important to recognize.
Right. This is fantastic. I want to talk about red flags and avoiding down the road, but I want to explore a little bit more, because one of the things I'm thinking is that these are so much trickier. You know, physical is something you can see, you can point to. And there's a spectrum, right?
Yes.
Of these kind of behaviors. How do you know what's abusive and what's normal? Where do you draw the line? I mean, I'm thinking especially what we're calling spiritual abuse. How do we just not say, well, this is just the way this particularly traditional role family is functioning, and it's normal.
Right. And in some way, I think we need to leave space for that. Some, you know, in many ways, you know, traditional gender roles, particularly in faith-based communities, and I'm not only talking about the Jewish community, is, I'm not saying the norm, but it is acceptable. What I see as kind of like diagnostic piece there is like, do you have voice about it? Like, and I use that language because the outcome might be the same. The outcome might be that you observe in this way or do it this way, but is there space in your relationship to say, I want to explore this, or I'm not comfortable with this, or I just have feelings about this. Can we discuss it? And even if the outcome is still going to be X, do I have the space to do that? If there isn't space and safety, right? You don't feel safe saying I'm struggling with this, then I'm not going to say you're abused. I don't jump to categorize anything, but I would say be curious. Like those are my, you know, for those who've heard me speak, I really try to think about like, how do you do this? Because I don't know that it's helpful to call things abusive that aren't abusive. I don't think it's helpful to call things that are abusive, not abusive. Like, right. I think we need to be, you know, but we don't need to jump to categorize, but you do need to be able to kind of figure out how you're feeling about it and be curious. So if you're not able to talk about something, is it because you don't have the skill set to talk about it? Do you need help figuring out how to talk about it? Is it because you're afraid to bring it up? Is it because you grew up in a way that it's just not traditional for you to even question, and now you're questioning? And are you in a relationship where there's space, and can it be opened up enough that you can try to explore it? And are you afraid to? So we go back to that definition, right? Like, is there fear? So it is very nuanced. It is very nuanced. And that's where, you know, here, you know, I am a mental health professional. And I do think that sometimes, or a lot of the time, it's worth speaking to someone who's trained. You know, we do not recommend couples counseling for people there is abuse. There's a lot of research that says that can be very dangerous. But certainly individual work to figure out what's going on. You know, is it really part of the dynamic? Is it you? Is there a combination? Are there things that are possible to change that you could learn more communication skills? Or are you afraid? And so, you know, that's where I get really curious. And the idea of being curious and not jumping to conclusions, I think is helpful and gives space and time for you to think things through. But give yourself permission, you know, to get the support about that, because
right.
It's hard to do alone.
Right. And listen to your gut, right?
Yeah. Listen to your gut, which is a hard thing to say.
I was going
to
say, right.
Right. So the listen to your gut part is like that. We often use that. Like we Shum Task Force, when we go into the high schools, we talk about like, listen to your gut. We have a whole list of questions of what that really means. And yes, I think we should listen to our gut. If you have that feeling and you can't see me, those listening to me, but like, you know, touching your stomach, like there's that little, like, I don't know, does this sit right? So that's where I say, listen to your gut and be curious, figure it out. Does that mean that you date a few more weeks and either get engaged feeling really good, or not get engaged to someone you don't want to be with? Like, those are both really good outcomes, right? The outcomes are both in many ways good, right? One's either you're in a relationship you want to be in, or you're not in a relationship you don't want to be in. But so people who, not everybody has that gut. Maybe they grew up in a home where they've witnessed domestic violence, or maybe they have their own other types of trauma, or they doubted themselves. So how do you start to kind of develop, like, trusting yourself so that, you know, think about ways and that's where I'd say it's really important to get support. Like, how do you learn to trust yourself? And if you're not in a space to trust yourself, how do you have the right people and not committees and large people you're schmoozing about your whole life with, but having the right people, the right professionals in your life that could help you think things through in a safe way. And that's really important.
Wait, are there certain groups that are more susceptible to being in such a relationship?
So there's a lot of people will talk about, you know, if you grew up witnessing family violence, you're more likely to become a victim. And if you grew up, or you're more likely to become a perpetrator. You know, if you have poor self-esteem, or you have, you know, mental health issues, and, you know, there's probably truth to all of that. I don't know if this is not my professional hat per se, but I have a very hard time, you know, focusing on that, because I think it's very fatalistic. It's as a mental health practitioner, it does kind of takes away like the ability for change. And as a from Jew, I think like I think there's always space for bechira and choice and like hope. So But I do think that there's this idea of like you either repair or you repeat. And that's not true for everyone. But if someone is in a situation in which they have witnessed a lot of trauma, and what we know about abusers, this is not what we're talking about today, but like what we know about abusers is they have high ACEs scores, like, you know, adverse childhood experiences. Their scores are usually over 4. So that means they've had community violence, personal violence, you know, mental health, substance. They usually have pretty significant. Now, that doesn't mean that's an excuse, but it might be part of the larger narrative. And but if you know that about yourself, and you're at a place where you're dating, or you're in a marriage, and then get support, because you're absolutely capable of having a loving, safe relationship. Everybody can do that. Like we all know people in our lives that have significant mental health issues, that have really hard childhood trauma, and they have beautiful marriages, not marriages without struggle, because reality is everybody struggles in their relationship. And that's something that we don't talk about enough. But so I don't like to kind of speak too much about like, oh, this person's destined. And I think that's where
no.
the language goes. I know you weren't asking that.
That was not what I was asking at all.
I know, but a lot of people, but I think that there is something to say, like, if I know that I'm from a family that, and I witnessed this as a child, so take some time and get support before or during. I mean, if you're listening to this and you're starting to date, so find someone now, you know, try to repair some of that now and get the support. If you're in a marriage right now and you're seeing certain things, get support. You deserve it. Like, you deserve the repair.
Right.
So that's my kind of way. The way I really think.
And the reason I asked very specifically is because when we talk about support, you're really talking about therapy.
Yeah, I'm mostly talking about therapy.
Yeah, this is Mental Health Awareness Month. This is May when we're recording this.
Absolutely.
Mental Health Awareness Month. And, you know, when I said before, trust your gut, and then I said, ooh, maybe you don't have a good
gut,
you know, finger on your own pulse, is that's what therapy can do. Rather than repair or repeat, you can repair from the get-go. If you feel like you're not sure about your gut and maybe you have these past history, then that's the time to go get professional help. As a preventative.
Yeah. And thank you for highlighting that, because like, you can have a good relationship, relationship in your life. And I think that sometimes people get into a space where they feel despair.
No.
Like, oh, this is why my mother went through, this is my father went through, I'm going to go through this. And that's just not true. Like
100%.
You deserve to have the healing that you need. And you can have a beautiful future family life, and there's support for it. The community has support for it. You know, we're in a totally different place than we were there. I mean, you know, there's Shalom Task Force, which has our hotline, helpline, chat line, you know, but there's also, we have many colleagues out there that are doing incredibly impactful work to help people. Mental health is really, we keep on destigmatizing it, and we're making headway, you know, that there are a lot of practitioners that can really help people.
Right. I want to end with a list of some besides how to reach you at the very end. And I also want to put them in the show notes, because I think giving resources is really, really important. But I want to go back a little bit before we get to prevention, because we could just segue right into prevention right now, but I don't end flags, but I don't want to do that yet, because I want to go back a little bit to the cycle of abuse. And the reason I want to say that is because another problem with trusting your gut is this is not a black or white. You're either in an abusive situation or you're not. So can you explain the cycle of abuse?
You know, in many ways, you know, I think back to the many survivors that I had the opportunity to work with. And if it was, first of all, if it was physical and if it was black and white and very clear all the time, then it's almost easy. They would say like, if he would just, or she would just hit me. And I'd say men are also to be survivor victims. And I want to be clear about that. I try very hard to be clear about using, you know, non-gendered language, just because I want to make sure men also are recognized as being hurt at times. You know, if it was only, they would say, if it was only black and white or black and blue, then, you know, everybody would believe me, like anyone who I'd go to, you know, my Rav, my mother, they would believe me, and everybody would come around and support me. But because it's kind of less obvious, because we don't know as much about the coercive control. We don't know, though it's as painful, like survivors will tell you, it's just more painful. So the cycle of abuse, what people talk about, it doesn't happen for everyone this way, is that there's kind of tension building, there's some sort of incident, then there's a honeymoon, right? So it might be better for a while, and then it goes back into this tension building. And we think about it as kind of this circle that gets closer and closer. And when we're doing, and this is not what, you know, when you're in the field here, there are like certain measures you take when you're doing intakes of clients, and you're going through this risk assessment, and you chart the calendar to see. And sometimes that helps us predict when we're really looking to prevent injury, right? That's, you know, that's one part of our job, is to help people prevent injury and fatality. And it needs to be said, that's actually the stake sometimes. Like sometimes that is what's happening. Most of the time, it's not always in that realm. But the part about the cycle of abuse, which does not happen for everyone, is really the recognition is that there's a honeymoon time, and that there are times that feel really good, and that they could be good with each other. And that's the part that gets really confusing. It's also the part that instills hope for change in the survivor victim, so that they kind of stick around a lot, right? It's almost kind of like a carrot. It's like, well, that was one thing. It wasn't so bad, but you know, we have months of good or weeks of good. And then, but he or she can be good. And then, you know, the person will be less likely to explore other options. I want to be clear, like anyone who works in the field doesn't tell someone they should leave or not leave. That's just not our job. Mm-hmm. And it's really not our job also, because if this is about a dynamic of power and control, in no way do I want to be part of that dynamic. So if I tell someone they have to leave, I'm really asserting the same power and control, right? So, you know, we would never say to someone, oh, you have to leave. We might explore them. Like, let's think about what's available to you. You know, how do you stay safe if you're staying in a relationship? How do you become safer? What other things can, you know, enrich your life? Would you like to think about what it would be like if you decide that you might want to leave the relationship? What does that look like? But in no way that people in this field tell people you have to leave. Right. And, you know, and I think it's important to say, because people sometimes think that they're going to call a hotline like Sham Task Force or any of my colleagues, and they're going to be told, okay, you have to go get divorced. We won't do that. We won't do that. It's like against our protocol and against our practice. So.
Right. I want to go back a little bit when you said honeymoon and really underscore that it's even more confusing, because when you say honeymoon, you don't just mean normal.
Right. So it could be normal for some people, but for a lot of people, it could be flowers and like really like what we would call like early marriage, like early relationship, infatuation, you know, loving adrenaline, all of that.
Love stuff. Bombing. It's called love,
you know,
bombing.
Love,
right?
Bombing. Yes. Yeah. And that's hard to leave. It's hard to think about leaving, you know, and it's very confusing. Right. It's like yesterday we were fighting and I was being hurt in this way. And today, and I was afraid of you. And today this is what's happening. Like, what's going on here? Am I going crazy? So often the love bombing and that whole piece, the person will almost deny and minimize what happened during the violent incident, violent being whatever sort of form of abuse. And they're like, that really didn't happen, or it wasn't that bad. Or, I'm not sure that you're really interpreting, you know, even if you brought it up, you know. But the evidence in front of you is the flowers or the chocolate or the vacation or whatever that thing that catches in your relationship. So it is very confusing. And those are the things that make it really hard for people to think clearly about what they want. The other part that makes it really hard is that if you're in the relationship in which you're supposed to be most cherished, right? And you're supposed to be most supported, and you're experiencing a lot of psychological, emotional, verbal abuse, your sense of self becomes shattered.
Right.
And if all your decisions within this relationship are being questioned for your competency, then how do you make decisions? And I teach graduate students, and I was working in a clinic. You know, we often think about some of the mostly women, but some of the survivors we meet with would be chronologically, you know, in their 40s and 50s. They're adult, like they were true adults, you know, not young adults. And they would almost feel adolescent when you were talking to them, and they couldn't think things through. And I always had to like take a step back and say, well, they haven't been trusted and don't trust their own decision making for so long, that they in some way are still in that adolescent kind of like figuring things out, and we have to help nurture them so that they could be able to make decisions and feel empowered decisions.
Right. What do you mean by nurture? Because I'm thinking back to you saying, well, we're not going to make that decision for them. That's just another,
I'm famous for this one little incident, and I'll share with you. When I was seeing survivors, you know, that was my whole practice at a nonprofit. I had a whole display of teas, like every tea flavor you could ever imagine. I did that because I was sitting patient after patient. I like drinking tea, but also it was like a nurturing thing. You come in, let's ground you. It was a way of having very traumatized individuals. But part of it was also like you're allowed to enjoy something. And I had a client, and this was like kind of my standard where they come in. I'm like, the first session would be like, what kind of tea do you want? Whatever you have. And by the third or fourth session, they would say, I'm thinking of particularly one client, I want a blueberry tea with a little bit of milk and two Splendas, right? Now, it's a kind of a mushel, right? It's an analogy. Like all of a sudden, you know, she had the right to say what I want and not be demanding, but to ask for it, right? And that is in some way a parallel process of how do I know that I deserve? And sometimes the word deserve was very triggering to survivors. Can be very, because like, what did they actually deserve? What does that actually mean? But like, I have the right to say, I want something. Now, it doesn't mean I'll get it every single time, but I'm allowed to have opinions and they're not gonna be questioned. You're allowed to have your blueberry tea. And you want milk with it? That's fine. Like, you know, to me it was always, and survivors, my clients would also would like that analogy in some way when we were able to see it, you know, a few weeks later, a few sessions later, like, wow, like you're right. I haven't been allowed to, I didn't have space. I felt so unsafe. I didn't know how to ask for something I needed and I never got it, or I didn't get it enough. And here we're going to start building you up.
Right.
And that's what a lot of this work is building someone up. And then whatever decision they make at the end, and it's often not a linear process. It's not like, oh, okay, now I'm going to leave. No, they might stay for decades, you know, but are there ways in that relationship they feel safer? Are there physical ways to be safer? Like, can we think through how do you stay safer during a violent incident? Are there emotionally safer ways? Like, can you nurture yourself? Can you have mother interests? Are there ways to create space for you? You know, and we really try to think through with them. How to grow in that way. And if they choose, if they make the decision that they want to leave the relationship, how do you do that safely? Because that could be dangerous. So,
right. I think a lot of people don't understand. They'll say, why did you stay?
Oh, yeah. That is, right? I mean, that's the visceral response, right? Like, right. Why would you stay? And so, you know, there's probably 200 reasons why people stay. I think there's the practical reasons. You know, I think about like just how do you actually mobilize to leave? Like, where do you physically go? Like, how do you afford to do that? Right. There are ways, you know, this is what the field does. And then there's, you know, there's the emotional reasons. And I think we forget about that. There's love, you know, nobody, particularly in the communities that we're speaking to, like you don't go to the chuppah wanting this, like you've invested. There's a communal investment in your marriage. You know, you really think about, and then there's the personal reasons, you know, maybe, whatever your own issues are, you're there with that person. But I think something that we really want to think about is like the social cultural reasons. Like, how do we as a community either positively or negatively impact the person's ability to think about if they want to leave? You know, how do we create spaces for single parents that they still feel part of the community? Right? I mean, like, it's really hard. It's really, you know, speaking to the audience that I'm sure is listening here, they get it. But when I speak to some audiences and I describe what it must be like for a single mom to take her son to shul on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, that's complicated, right? And I don't know that I have the solution, but we do need and we have made progress in this, but how do we make sure people feel that they're still part of a community? We don't want people, we want people to feel, you know, this is their community of origin. This is their community as well. And to really think about, you know, the shame factor, even the language of like, my marriage failed, right? Like,
it's not your fault. That's why I titled the talk, it's not your fault.
But also like the language of failed is like, right. So, I don't know, to all of us, failed is like, I don't know, when you're in school and you really mess up, right? And like, is that what it means? Like,
right. But that goes back to the whole idea of you don't trust yourself because you have been intentionally undermined this entire time.
Yes.
Putting all those factors aside, if you don't trust yourself to pick tea,
right?
How are you going to trust yourself to leave?
Right. And to figure out what it means. And then there to whatever it means, you're, whatever that situation would be, with children, without children, all the complications of, you know, of what divorce means. Divorce is not simple. You know, so yeah, I mean, it's a lot. But if someone's contemplating, there is support. I don't want to be like, people should get support to be able to make that decision, and then support through that decision. And us as community members, you know, I'm not here only as a practitioner. We're here as community members also. How do we create communities in which we support people in different situations that we're sure to support them?
Right. You know, it's really important to talk about is that the gaslighting, right, the undermining of self is not just to the partner, right? It's also to people in their support system.
Right.
So I think I want you to go into that a little bit more, because how can we as people surrounding that person who's in a abusive relationship not get caught up in that? How can we be more helpful?
Do you want to share a little more what you've witnessed so I can respond, or I can tell you what I'm thinking?
So what I mean is that it's all he says, she says, right? Yes. So somebody from the community may say, this is a fine, upstanding person. I can't believe that they're not amazing. That's another problem with trying to figure out
right.
whether you trust yourself, whether you can leave, you know, where you're going to get the support from.
Right. And I think that's what gets very confusing to people, because people have, and this is true in the child sexual abuse world as well, right? We have this very strange little picture in our head of what an abusive person, you know, a person that hurts looks like, right? They're in a trench coat, right? That's who does child sexual abuse. But we all know that that's not true, right? Right. Children are mostly perpetrated by people in their close circles. Right. That's what we know. And the reality is, we think about an abusive spouse as being this out of control man, which is not true. The vast majority of people who hurt their partners are people that the rest of us think are like reasonable community members. They hold down jobs. They might have responsibilities in our shuls and schools. They could be, you know, the school president, the shul president, the vice president. You know, she could be the head of PTA. There's, you know, this is not an anger and control issue. They don't have anger issues, most of them, in their workplace. They're not yelling at their secretary in this way. This is something that happens within their home. And so when we do things like, well, he's such a nice guy, or she's amazing, and she's always cooking moms for meals for moms. And yes, that's all true too, right? That can be true, that in a public space, they could behave in that way, but in their home, and we don't know what happens behind people's doors, right?
Exactly.
Right. You know, and it is in a sense of, and then people will take sides, which is just not helpful. Helpful.
This happens in sex abuse too. So this is a very familiar conversation. Right. I did an interview with Zaka about all of this.
Oh yeah, sure.
I don't want to stereotype per se, but I really do want you to talk a little bit about the profile of an abuser and why they might be even more likely to be believed, right?
Right. So the profile abuser often looks like a very charismatic, put together person. Doesn't mean all of them are, you know, but a lot of them, you know, doesn't mean that they're the wealthiest person in the show, but usually they are able to hold down jobs. They have businesses. They're not marginalized people of our community. They can be anyone in our community, as can the survivor. The survivor on the outside will often, you know, hold down a job, look, be involved in their community. You know, there is a dynamic at times which the survivor will, because of the behaviors and the abuse, will come across as very disheveled and mentally ill. And it kind of feeds into the narrative, so that if, and I remember one client sharing, like the husband really kind of sabotaged her in her community relationships. And then he's like, well, if you ever leave me, who do you think they're going to believe would be a better parent? Like you are publicly, you know, so disheveled and not put together. But it really can be anyone. That's not to say that people should be scared, you know, like we shouldn't be scared. We just need to be aware, you know, it could be anyone, but it's not everybody. You know, most people are good people or good enough people and really try to be good partners. So that's, you know, we just need to be cognizant of it and look, be curious when you see something, when you're dating someone, to not to sweep it under, like to really be curious and explore it to make sure it's a good fit for you.
By the way, there's an interesting storyline in Mishpacha magazine. I don't know if you've seen it. There's a serialized story.
Yes, I have not caught up over the last few weeks. So
where it sounds like there's a lot of red flags.
Yeah.
This guy. We'll see what happens with that.
Yeah.
So I really do want to talk about it. I'm sorry.
Good for them putting out there, because those are the ways, that's like how people learn it, right? You know,
right.
I often talk about like muscle memory. Like the more we see it, the more we like, then when it's in front of us, it's not like we know how to respond, you know, and it's important for us to do that.
Right. So I do want to talk about red flags.
Okay.
At this point.
Red flags.
Good
red
segue.
Flags. Okay. I don't have a list in front of me. We're just moving. But red flags, the biggest one that we see is possessiveness, isolation, and control. You know, our dating is different. Dating in our communities are different. There's a continuum listening here, but you know, isolation to us is a big, big red flag. Now, that often will look like doting in the beginning of a relationship and can feel really good. And it might just be doting, but that's when we get curious. If the person is trying to cut you off from all of your friends and family, no one's good enough for you, and we're too firm, or they're not firm enough, or you know, like some sort of, you know, and because that is a very effective way of controlling someone, because they will not have people in their lives, right? They just, people, you know, isolation is hugely controlling. So I'd say that's something that we see a lot of here. Dishonesty and lying, like the stories just don't make sense. Like talking about everybody always being the victim in every story, never taking responsibility, like never being feeling responsible. You're having a disagreement when you're dating, and it's not the end of the world to disagree when you're dating. It's probably a good thing, because in life you will disagree, right? In a healthy enough marriage, you will disagree. And how can you work it out? But never being the one that's wrong, never being able to say you're sorry in a real way, never taking accountability. People will talk about, being rude to the waiter. Yeah, I would, being rude to people that you don't need to be kind to is a problem, because eventually they won't need to be kind to you. Right now they do, because they're trying to marry you. But, being unkind to waiters, being very entitled, feeling like you're walking on eggshells and you're afraid if you can't bring things up, not having personal space. I think a lot of times young adults, when they're dating, kind of romanticize the fact that you'll have all the same hobbies, you'll really enjoy each other all the time, like you'll be perfectly aligned. It is perfectly fine and healthy to have an independent life. Like it does, I'm not saying a parallel life, but you're allowed to have your own interests. You're allowed to have your own friends at time. You're allowed to create space for your friends, and that not being respected, to me, it'd be like, what's that about? And discuss what that's about. If you're in graduate school or in school and you express that you need some time to work on a paper, and the person that you're dating keeps on interrupting you and not letting you have time to study and not respecting that boundary, I would be concerned about that. And when I say, that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying break it off. I'm not saying break the engagement. I'm not saying run away. I'm saying that's when you get curious and you say something to the effect of, I'm really working hard on my comps right now. I need some time to do this. I feel like I shared that with you. How can we work this out? And but I need you. Well, that might feel really good, but you need to be able to have space and respect each other's spaces. So those are the kind of things we look for. So jealousy. Saying that you're flirting with people when you're not flirting with people and like really jumping on you. So, but red flags are red flags, right? And when you see a red flag, that's when you get curious and figure out how you want to deal with it. And that's when you should have people in your life, not huge amounts of people, but people in your life to discuss it with, to help you to figure out how can you address it. You want to be able to address the issue and then see if there's a resolution. Like, can the behavior change? Was the person able to understand it? And then pushing you beyond your comfort zone. Many of our listeners or many of our community members may be shomer negiah when they're dating, but there are those who are not, and there are those who have their own version of what that looks like. And respecting your boundaries around that and not pushing you there is important. And that's something we do see, even the most, communities that you wouldn't expect it from. We see a lot of that. And that's a very manipulative tool, because it can be used later to kind of blackmail people in relationships. So there's a whole list there. And are there positive markers? Someone who does respect your space, right? And someone who is honest and respectful and, wants to integrate your friends into their life, however that works in your community. And even if your family is not perfectly hashkafically aligned with you, finds, strengths in them and helps you figure out a relationship with them. Those are positive markers. And then there's the in-between where you work hard on things and you adult up, and it's part of adulting, and you work it out. So
what are ways that we can help our friends and family? I'm thinking about, say, you're the parent of a dating mm-hmm. child, or you're the friend of someone who is starting to question her marriage. What are ways we can help? What are things we shouldn't do too? I like to add that in.
So the do's and don'ts, have a list somewhere of do's and don'ts. So some of the do's is using I language and not pushing people to make, like not giving advice, right? Like, so again, I would never tell someone what to do. A community member, a friend, a family, don't tell them what to do. What happens in that situation is that they automatically will kind of align with their partner, right? And then you become not accessible to them anymore, because later when if they do have this like epiphany is like, I need help, they feel like you've already tried. You might not, you're not going to be as accessible to them. So you want to not tell them what to do, but just you could share, like, I feel a little concerned, or you don't really seem so happy, and can I be helpful to you in any way? Or if they do disclose something to you, to really say right away, I believe you, not ask what did you do, or I believe you, how can I be helpful? I'm here for you. You're not alone. Knowing resources, social and task force is obviously one of them, but knowing resources, there are people out there can help you. You're not the only one. You're not the only one in our community who's gone through this. There are agencies committed to this, you know, like, and so they don't feel alone, but not to tell them what to do, to share concerns in a very kind of non-aggressive way, not making them feel judged. The thing I often tell, and I do consult with families who see things in their family, you know, usually their children that they're scared of, is that, and sisters, I often get sisters that call, it's not a time that it's going to be a mutually like caring relationship, right? The person's being controlled. And so they're not calling you as much. They're not being as supportive. And sometimes what happens is that the families and their friends like get annoyed and sad and hurt by that. And they cut off. So you're giving and you, and all of a sudden the relationship isn't what it was. And then what happens, that person gets further isolated. So what I always really recommend is that just know that if your friend's going through this, they're not going to be a friend to you right now in the way that you're used to. And that's okay. Get your help. You should get support from other places. Right. You should, but don't allow that to cut off, because they're going to need you.
Right. Hold on.
Yeah. They're going to need you and be an anchor. Even though it's painful and it's their process. And, you know, just to remain, you know, non-judgmental. I mean, as a community, things we do is like this podcast. I mean, I have to say that every time I have the, you know, honor and fun, I love being a podcast. I love meeting new people.
Whatever
podcast, we get so many calls to our hotline of people saying, oh, I heard Shauna and it resonated. I didn't realize abuse was X. I didn't know there was time for this. And so I think when we put it out there, in any kind of subtle way, when we have signs at our shuls, at our GCCs, at our mikvahs, when you know, anytime something's out there, it's a message to the survivors. And I say survivors as the full term, but people who are still in a relationship at all, we call them survivors. But to the survivors and victims that like, we see you,
right.
Like, you know. Like there's an org, and I think it's exceptionally meaningful, you know, to know that there are agencies within our community that are committed to you, and you're not like the one. There are, you know, tragically, but we get thousands of calls. So like, you know, but that's good. People are reaching out. People always ask, like, you know, we had a real uptick in calls in the last few years, maybe related to COVID, not related to COVID, whatever the reason is. And someone's like, isn't that sad? I said, no, because people are always being hurt. Now they know they can get help. And right, I don't think it means more people are being abused.
You don't know that though. If that were, that would be very not good.
Right. We don't know.
Right. But I want to make the point though. I want to underscore again the power of everybody surrounding the survivor.
Yes.
Right. I think their awareness also of not falling into the pattern of supporting the abuser over the victim.
Right.
Which is the same thing we have to deal with the sex abuse.
Right. Absolutely. Right. And then, you know, there's the practical things. If people are going through a separation, things are hard. Like, how can you be helpful to them? And that's not, you know, do kids need play dates? Do kids need rides places? I mean, if you're in a position to financially help, I mean, people do exceptional things in our community to help people. And to think about that. But I think as a community, just as like a larger, like community discourse, is to talk about it. Like the more we talk about it, the people in the situation will get help. Right. I mean, it's clear. That's what we see happen.
But not to publicly take sides.
No, you don't have to take public sides. There's no need to. And that's the thing. But like, how do you know that? I'm like, I'm not a judge. I'm not the judge and jury. It's just not my role.
Right.
My role is to be present for someone who's going through something very painful. It is not my role. I'm not, you know, just not who, that's not the judge. I'm not the judge. And to remember that. You know, there are people in that role. I'm gratefully not. So,
right. Yeah. We need to finish up. We could talk forever, but we need to talk about safety before we finish.
Safety.
So we need to know what people can do if they themselves are in this position of an abusive relationship, and what their family and friends can do.
So we
in a situation of actual
physical danger,
really.
Okay. So if you're listening to this and you're in a place of physical danger, I would say to you, call. I know this is like kind of default. You need to think of a safety plan, and they're very, very specific to your situation. You know, some of it becomes very like, where are there exits in your home? How do you make sure that the fight doesn't happen in the kitchen or the bathroom? Because those are just more dangerous spaces. You know, we really want to think through physically, like where you could position yourself that you're safest. We never blame the victim, but often they could predict when things are happening. So it's kind of a weird thing. So can you anticipate something happening and make sure people are safe? You know, we have lists of things you might want to keep copies of, your birth certificates, your social security cards, know where your ketubah is, you know, how do you, you know, having a cell phone on you if to call 911 if you're in that danger. So there are very specific things like that. But I don't want to get too into it right now. I know that we are, but because it really is very case specific,
right?
In the sense of like, call our hotline, speak to someone at OHEL or Jewish Board has a wonderful initiative, Leave Initiative. All through the country, there are agencies that are committed to Jewish domestic violence survivors or general domestic violence survivors. The hotline is fantastic to really think through how do you keep yourself as safe as possible. Just like a fire drill, it's better to plan it before it happens. So if you're in a honeymoon period or things are a little calmer right now, it's a great time. Right. It's a great time to kind of say, OK, things feel better right now. Maybe it won't happen again, but maybe they will. And if they do, this is how we want to be able to deal with it. You know, the more dangerous part times are when people are planning on leaving and when they've left, because that's kind of the dynamic of power and control starts shifting. And the person that hurts, the abusive party, usually picks up on it. And that should be done with very careful case management to make sure that you have things in place so that. That you're as safe as possible in the situation. But to think about it, when we're under extreme danger, we go into fight or flight mode. That's what we do. And we want to prevent that. We want to be able to have a plan in place.
Or freeze.
Yes. Fight, freeze. Right.
So this is a great time for you to give those resources, but also to underscore again, that for people who are listening, who are not the survivor, /victim, but our surrounding supportive people, you should write these down too.
Yes, absolutely.
And I'll say that. Hold on, because they may not be ready for it at the time that you're
absolutely.
Listening.
And I'll say that our hotline gets, I didn't check the numbers recently, but at times it would be between 25 and 30% of the callers are actually not the survivors themselves. Right. They're family members and concerned parties. And that's what it's there for, right?
Right.
To really think it through with you in your individual situation of your friend, of your daughter, of your son. So our hotline, chat line, WhatsApp line is 888-883-2323. There are a number of other initiatives that are really important. I know this is a national hotline. We actually hear from Jewish survivors all over the world. And we could help connect people to places in their community. You know, in New York, there's Jewish Board, the Leave Initiative, there's OHEL, there's Met Council, the J.C. Goral, Nassau County. There's going to be colleagues of mine saying you forgot to say us. But there's like, you know, in Baltimore, there's something called Kana, and Chicago, there's Shalva. There are programs all over the country. But we can help people get to those, kind of the general referral for that. And then there's the hotline.org, which is, the national general domestic violence hotline, which is very, very helpful as well. So there are resources. If you are in the situation and you are looking online, please make sure to clean your history. You're on your web. There's lots of wonderful resources online. Just use websites and online in a safe way. If you go to our website, there's an exit. Most domestic violence websites have exits that take you to weather or google.com in case you need to have Swift. But just to be aware of your digital safety as well. So to erase any on your phone, any sort of log that you've called any of these agencies is an important thing to know to keep you safe as well.
That is important. You've given us so much information, and I want to thank you so much. I'm going to have you for part two for all the topics we didn't
cover. Absolutely. My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Be well and have a good Shabbos.
Good Shabbos.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org, that's JOWMA.org, or email us at health@joma.org.